So could we start with a description? What is Farmer to Farmer?
Farmer to Farmer is a volunteer program for American farmers and other experts to travel overseas for short-term projects. It's a volunteer program, which means your expenses are covered. You're driven around, you're picked up at the airport, they put up, you know, they pay your motel or hotel, and it's usually a 2 or 3 week project overseas, some foreign country, and you deal with some agricultural topic. You usually teach, of course you teach, a lot of times do farm visits, sometimes, you know, working with industry and doing other things. So I did a leather project once, which was very different. I did milk quality. I've done a lot of grazing stuff. I did silage making. I did record keeping. I did farm budgets. I taught university students on Farmer to Farmer, you know, on campus. So there's a variety of things that go on, and it's not just cattle, it's sheep, goats, it's horticulture, vegetables, you know, like I said, leather. I had to do a lot of work on that one because I didn't know much about the leather industry, but I did a good project in Kenya.
So you've done a number of things in international agriculture. How did you get involved with Farmer to Farmer?
I discovered the program at some point. I don't really remember when Farmer to Farmer started, but it's been in existence for a while, and I discovered Farmer to Farmer. I think I did my first one about 12 years ago, maybe, and I went to Honduras. That was my first Farmer to Farmer. I had already done international work through the Babcock Institute in Madison. I did my own independent kind of Farmer to Farmer through the USDA. I wrote a grant one time and went to Costa Rica a couple times on that one. State Department paid for a Cyprus project that I did, agriculture. You know, so there's different funding sources, but most of it is U.S. government, of course. Most of it is USDA, and there's a number of organizations that bid every 5 years to do parts of the world. So Partners of the Americas does Latin America, parts of it, not all of it. WinRock is in many places, and they're based in Arkansas. CNFA is Southern Africa. Catholic Relief Services was East Africa. Now they've expanded to other parts of the world, including Asia. You know, it's a wonderful way to get out. And I did it throughout my extension career on vacation time. You know, a couple of the counties I worked in said, well, you can do some of this on our time, you know, because they were paying part of my salary. And I said, no, thank you. I get a month of vacation every year. I said, I'll take 2 or 3 weeks and do Farmer to Farmer. And then the other week I go with my wife somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to keep her happy, you know. And so I always fit it in. I never took extension time to do my international work. That is precious to me. And if I did extension time, I'd have to ask extension. I'd have to ask Burnett County, Washburn County, Sawyer County. I'd have to go through a whole bunch of, you know, permission, you know, requests. And I said, nah, I'm not going to bother with that. I just told my counterpart, I said, I'm going to be gone from here to here. I just leave. But I'm always in touch, too. I mean, I was always in touch. Email, you know, from Kenya or Ethiopia, you know, I'd email into the office. Well, is anything going on? You know, did anybody come in my office and ask any questions? And I try to answer the questions for Wisconsin when I was out there somewhere.
So you've done most of your work in Africa. So tell me some of the things that you've learned about agriculture in those countries that is different from ours.
It's tropical, for one thing, you know, so warm weather, no freezing, you know, there's no frost. 12 daylight and night, you know, it's pretty close to, see, the farther north or south you are, of course, the daylight varies, you know, during the year. It's mostly a 12-12 schedule, so you think about those things. What have I learned? Farmers are the same everywhere. They have a lot of the same concerns. Farmers, unfortunately, are, I think, taken advantage of by federal governments. because farmers don't start revolutions, but hungry city people do. So there's it's an axiom in political science that you have to keep a cheap bread policy for city people so they don't go out on the streets. Farmers will not start revolutions, they just work harder.
Yep.
So I learned that in the political science, and it's pretty obvious around the world. So there's a whole different, I mean, grazing's the same in a sense. I'm an expert on a few tropical tree legumes, and we don't feed tree leaves to animals here.
Yes, the crop's a little different.
But you do in the tropics. And so I always promote that a lot. What you need to do in any system is look at what the farmer is doing and try to fit within his budget and his context any changes that he might make. And they're always going to be local, you know. I'm not going to try to sell anything from the States. Maybe an idea, you know, but, you know, they have to work within their context. So having a lot of tropical experience, you know, I told the Ethiopians this last time, I told them what was going on in Kenya, you know. I showed them photographs from Kenya, from Mozambique, from Mali, from Nicaragua, from Costa Rica, from Honduras. I said, well, here's what these people are doing, you know, and they're not that much different than you are, you know. So how do they work, you know, what kind of crops do they plant, and what kind of systems do they have for, you know, what kind of cattle do they have, and so that's the way I, you know. And it's always at their level, you know. They're precious people. It's not from me up here to you down. No. Forget that, you know. Just get relaxed with the farmer, try to figure out what's going on, and, you know, just point to the neighbor, maybe, you know, say, hey, why is he doing that? Why aren't you doing this? You know. So
the hardships that farmers in the U.S. face really aren't all that different from the hardships that farmers in Ethiopia or other countries like that face.
Yeah, getting enough for their product, you know. Droughts, weather, you know, climate is a big deal everywhere.
Yeah. How does climate influence them?
Well, it's getting more and more erratic, so it's a little hard for them to figure their way around droughts and wet seasons and what crops to grow. You know, you have to diversify more so that if one thing fails, two things fail, you got another one you can lean on, you know, for that year. I mean, we have this huge problem of overproduction in the States, and it's because we do things too well. We jump on technology really fast compared to Ethiopian farmers, you know. A lot of the countries, like I said before, that I work in have an undersupply. They don't produce enough. They have to import, or people just do without, you know. They just eat less of it, you know. So there's a lot of cultural issues that are, you know, when you're talking about an Orthodox population in Ethiopia or a Muslim population in Mali, they have their own preferences of what they want to do, what they eat, what they don't eat. Ethiopian practicing Orthodox Christians, if they follow the dictates of their diets, they do not consume meat or milk 200 days of the year. Because they do not eat milk or eat meat on Wednesday and Friday of every week. That's 100 days. Plus Lent. Plus this and that. I don't know. But one of my students calculated that a practicing Orthodox Christian in Ethiopia will not consume dairy products, for instance, 200 days of the year. So what does that do to the demand? I mean, it just really reduces the demand.
And how do they adapt to their diets like that? Because here in America, you know, we kind of just eat what we want when we want. Catholics might eat fish on Friday, but
they eat a lot of beans and rice. and you know they have cowpeas, chickpeas, and they have a lot of different teff grain. They have a lot of local foods that they eat that we don't eat so much of. Of course, tropics have fruits everywhere, you know, so they have tropical fruits. There's a lot of fish in some countries. You know, they depend a lot on fish. My impression is that farmers are the same everywhere, and they have the same concerns. A lot of times they also have the same mindset. I would say I told my Ethiopian hosts, I said, well, you know, these were master's degree level people when I was there last time. I said, I can walk on a farm in Wisconsin, can look at the farm and I can look at the owner and I can say, nothing's going to happen here until the owner dies. You know, I mean, that's harsh, but it's, you know, people have a mindset and they don't adapt. You know, they don't change things. They don't say, hey, this is not working. They just keep doing the same thing over and over again. Not everybody, but I see this. And especially the older generation who maybe has the farm paid for and there's no reason to change.
Right.
You know, just keep doing what they do and then eventually they sell. The thing that I, you know, and I rode around in Ethiopia, I've seen farms and, you know, windshield appraisals kind of thing, you know, going down the road in some little bus. And there's so many people in Ethiopia that are still, they're hoeing, you know, and they're cutting their grain with a little knife, not even a scythe, but just a little knife, and they're whipping their oxen to plow, and then they're using their donkeys to haul things around, and they live on $300 a year, maybe total income, $400, I don't know, not a lot. They can barely, you know, they can't imagine even traveling or even maybe going to the city. And I've seen that in a number of places, and it's, you know, eventually things change. I mean, we had more primitive kind of agriculture too, you know, but the Kenyans are different. They like to make money. They have fences, and they have, some of them make silage, and they have Western cows, and if they don't have a pickup truck or a car, they at least have a motorcycle, and they got a nice house on the farm, and they got an iPhone. You know, it's a different level. It's just a different progression, you know. This is kind of off the subject, but the one Ethiopian student I had, he says, what makes Kenya more advanced than Ethiopia? And I said, well, one of the things is Ethiopia has never really been colonized. The Italians were there for a while, and they left some things behind, but the Kenyans were colonized by the British, and the British imposed a rigorous change on the system, in agriculture in particular. The second thing is the Kenyans have a lot of tourists. You know, they come and look at animals, but they put a lot of money in the system. The third thing is Kenyans really like to make money. Fourth thing is Kenyans plant trees. Ethiopians cut trees. Kenyans love to plant trees. And there's something about the environment. There's something about growing trees that makes everything better. They like to plant trees. The fifth thing is Kenyans have a working knowledge of English at the farm level. They didn't in the 70s. A lot of the farmers, I had to use Swahili. Now every farmer speaks English. Everybody's gone to school. Everybody speaks English. When you go on the internet, what are you going to find in Amharic, you know, for the Ethiopians? You'll find some information. But if you want to find information, you're going to find it in a major Western language, not Amharic. And Kenyans on the farm level speak English. So they can go online and they can get information. If it doesn't come to them, they can go find it, you know. So that's another huge advantage that Kenya has. So there are differences between countries, and some of it's cultural, historical. Oh, Kenya never had a government, they never had an overthrow. They never had a military government. Ethiopia had 17 years of Colonel Mengistu, who imposed communism on the country. Not only was he a brutal dictator, but he imposed the system that doesn't work, my opinion, doesn't work. Ethiopia was basically set behind about 30 years because of government, because of the type of government they had. You know, they couldn't do anything. Well, they could, but they would have been killed. They couldn't do anything about it. Eventually, he was overthrown, you know, and it's improved quite a bit since. So there's a lot of differences. I mean, we in the States, we have so much to be thankful for because of our stability, you know, our technology, our science, even if we disagree politically, we still work hard and you know, we do things, you know, we improve things, we build and all that, and some foreign countries just got all messed up, you know, and they just, things fall apart. There was a difference there. But, again, farmers are farmers. They complain about the same things. It's fun for me to work with farmers. Absolutely fun, because I've seen all types of farmers. One example of culture is Mali. I worked on a project in Mali with sheep and goats. And I was trying to get people to save money by marketing their animals at the festival periods when the sheep and goats are worth a lot more. But they don't do that because they have to keep some sheep and goats behind for medical emergencies or, you know, my wife needs a dress or something like that. And they will sell a goat or a sheep during the off season for half the price they would get at the holiday season. It's because they can't keep cash. If they have cash, they spend it. I mean, that's our problem too. If we have cash lying around, we tend to spend it, okay? We have to be disciplined. So I said, you know, does anybody put their cash in a bank? Nobody uses a bank. So it's a village system, okay? So the village, it's a communal village system in Mali, you know, the way they operate in a lot of, not entirely. So there was a place down the road that had a chicken factory. Big building with broilers in it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, who's this guy? This is obviously not a village situation. You know, he's some guy has got, you know, 10,000 broilers. And when the market is right, he sells them all on the market. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to sell chickens, he's going to come in there with chickens at half price, and he's still making more money than you're making on yours. You know, and then I said, you need to think about your marketing, and you need to think about your animal numbers and how to be more, you know, get your animals to market sooner, because they, you know, when they have a festival, they want an intact male goat that's 3 years old. Can you imagine what an intact male goat tastes like at 3 years old? It's a billy goat. It stinks. It's, you know, it's just a, and that's what they like, you know. So I said, why don't you castrate these goats and fatten them up and put them out on the market in a year and a half? They looked at me like, what? We never do that. That's not our tradition. So there's these impediments to tradition. Uh-huh. But I would talk about these examples of things where I said, somebody's going to come in here and put up a sheep factory or a goat factory, and they're going to undercut you, and they're going to have all these sheep and goats ready, thousands of them maybe, ready at market time. And you're going to be sitting there, instead of getting 300, you're going to get, you know, 200 or 175 for your highest price. And people, they didn't speak English, okay? I had a translator who went from English to Bambara.
Okay.
Mali is a French-speaking country, but Bambara was the major local language. We skipped the French. My translator went from English to Bambara and back to English again. So, I don't understand Bambara, but because they're Muslims, you hear some Arabic expressions.
Right.
And a couple of times I was mentioning these big things that could happen, you know, in the community, and then somebody would say, Ohala. All right. If God wishes, you know, God willing. Mm-hmm. Then I heard it again. Then the third time I heard it, I said to my translator, I said, tell these people, I said, in the West, we believe that God helps those who help themselves. And he translated it, and they were just sitting there, and they were looking at me like, oh, okay, you know. Because it's like they're waiting for something to fall out of heaven.
Uh-huh.
They won't change unless some, you know, they win the lottery or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Instead of making an attempt themselves, not waiting for God or something, I don't know, whatever, making an attempt themselves. So I heard Ohala, God willing, a couple times too many. I know the expression. I mean, I know a number of expressions in Arabic. And I just, okay. So I hope that was a take-home message for them. You know, a lot of it's pretty basic, but we can get into some detail, you know. And I like doing this kind of thing. It's, you know, I've got a background in nutrition, PhD in ruminant nutrition. I milk cows. I have a strong production background. I have a 4-H background. I have a financial background. I did a lot of different things. And so I went, and again in Ethiopia this last time, the guy says, "Why are you retiring? You know so much." I said, "I'm going to be 70 here pretty soon." And then I said, "We have a history of dementia in the family." And I said, "Ask me in 5 years if I still know who I am." I said, "I'm writing, you know, I'm writing and I'm traveling and I got to do stuff for myself, you know, because I've been working for everybody else all these years. I mean, for myself too." So that was kind of another one of these funny things that happened to me when I was over there. So anyway, we'll see how that dementia thing goes. Yeah. My parents were fine. My dad passed away 3 years ago, and his mind was good till the end. And my mom is feisty, stubborn, 92-year-old woman, and there's nothing wrong with her mind except that I think she's too opinionated. But my dad's three of his sisters, they went mentally, and on my dad's side especially, there was a lot of old age dementia. Not Alzheimer's, but just dementia. You know?
And runs in my family too.
Yeah. So I said, "Well, you know, I'm getting to that point where I better do what I need to do with my mind while I still can do it." Mm-hmm. And, you know, too bad. If I know so much, I can't work, you know, all the rest of my life doing this all the time, you know. So, whatever.